Blog Talk Radio.
Why does she get a blaster and I don't?
What?
I know how to use it.
That's what I'm afraid of. Give it to me.
We're going to Jeddah. That's a war zone.
That's not the point of... Where'd you get it?
I found it.
I find that answer vague and unconvincing.
Trust goes both ways.
You're letting her keep it. Would you like to know the probability of her using it against you? It's high.
Let's get going.
It's very high.
Oh, man, that's a great scene. Welcome, everybody, to Cinema Royale. I'm Travis Hobson, and it's Rogue One. It's a clip from Rogue One, the Star Wars story. That scene features Felicity Jones as Jen Erso, Diego Luna, Cassian Andor, and Alan Tudyk as the very funny, very sarcastic, very droll droid K2SO. So that's pretty much what we're going to be doing on this show right here, is talking about Rogue One, a Star Wars story. It's the only review we got this week. Y'all don't want to hear me talk about Collateral Beauty. You want to know my thoughts on Collateral Beauty with Will Smith? Go check out my review on punchdrunkcritics.com. You can find it there. But for now, we're going to be talking about Rogue One. And the person I'm bringing in to tell me to talk about that is someone I know is a huge fan of science fiction. And I think he's a big Star Wars fan. I know he's a huge fan of sci-fi. But I don't know if he's specifically a Star Wars fan. I know he loves Star Trek. I'm about to ask him about it. But it's my buddy Robert Aubrey Davis, who's never been on the show before. Now, those of you who live in D.C., you may know who Robert is. He's basically a Washington institution. And I want to say all this before he comes on, before he calls in, so he doesn't hear me, because I don't want to blow his head up. But Robert is a cultural icon here in Washington, D.C. And he's also the host of WETA Around Town, which is a show that I do on Channel 26, which is the local PBS station. Me and my buddy Tim Gordon, who you know is always on the show, and Robert's the host. And Robert knows something about everything, it seems. He's one of those types of people. And he's great to talk to. And you need to ask him a question about DC, he's going to know it. And I have a feeling he's going to be that way about Star Wars, too. But I've never found the perfect movie to bring him on the show for. I should have brought him on for Arrival a few weeks ago. He would have really dug that. We were both disappointed we didn't get a chance to do that on Around Town. Should have had him on the show for that. But having him on for Star Wars, it could be just as good. So he'll be calling in just a moment, and we're gonna get his thoughts on the movie. Also, let's see what's going on later on the show. Not a heck of a whole lot. We got DVDs and Blu-rays, of course. I'm going to let you know what's coming out next week for home release. There's a few good ones out there. And, of course, we got a little bit of news. Not a lot, but we got a few items that that caught my eye this week. So I'm going to bring those to your attention after we're finished with Rogue One. So stay tuned for that. All right. And what else? What are the Blu-rays this week? Yeah, well, okay, the news. The news has to do with an upcoming DC Universe movie. Actually, two DC Universe movies that are coming up. Actually, everything in the news this week has to do with DC movies that are coming up. So we're going to bring that news to you a little bit later on. But that's after we finish talking about Rogue One with my pal and host of WETA Around Town, Robert Arbor Davis, who I'm happy to bring on now. What's up, Robert?
Well, I'm great, Travis. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good, man. It's great to have you on the show for the first time. This is awesome.
Well, I love being here. It's a great and visionary experience since you deal with many issues, but particularly the science fiction fantasy world, which is a very worthy world to be involved in and to which to discourse extensively, you know.
Well, you know, the thing I was just talking about all that, and I was like, I know you love sci-fi, but I don't know how you feel about Star Wars specifically. Like, I know you love Star Trek. Why do you feel about Star Wars overall? Are you a huge fan?
I think I'm a profound science fiction person and have always
mm-hmm.
been. And I think the idea that there's some kind of a disconnect between, you know, they're the Trekkies or whatever you want to call them, and then there's the Star Warsians, whatever you want to call them, is kind of specious and short-sighted. I think we should be encouraging literally everything from the whole lineage of the so-called scientific science fiction, the 2001 Gravity slash type of The Martian, you know, the so-called realism in science fiction, through the wildest flights of fantasy you can come to. And I think in all of aspects of that, that is actually science fiction, and very specifically separate from fantasy. I mean, that they are not the same.
Mm-hmm.
They're very different. And I sort of follow along with a lot of the both Golden and Silver Age writers that
mm-hmm.
they have a very distinct feeling and philosophy about what science fiction actually is and what it's for and what it is really about and why it is such a remarkable genre and why it can do so much in such a profound and meaningful way. I have a rather interesting story of the genesis of Star Wars through a friend of mine, if you want to hear it.
Yeah,
the
please.
Whole series. A friend of mine is a very famous novelist, and he was part of the writer's workshop with those young guys out of USC in the early 1970s, and particularly Francis Ford Coppola, who was sort of the more mastermind. He'd known about young George Lucas because of THX 1138, and
yeah.
he was writing, the idea was they were going to write something about the Vietnam War, which is so enormously overshadows everything from that era. As a theme, and they were really trying to place it in the world of space and kind of, you know, what that does is it takes a very specific idea, that is to say, the oppressive capitalist, you know, imperialist world oppressing a young rebellion. That was sort of the romantic notion of
mm-hmm.
the anti-war movement, and created so that it would not seem quite so profoundly pungent, slap in the face anti-war. And there was a split that occurred fairly early on in which quite literally the decision was made to give up the fantasy piece of it, the science fiction piece of it, to the Lucas group who created the Star Wars universe and retained the more realistic world, which became Apocalypse Now under Coppola.
Wow.
And so both of those are films about the exact same thing with the exact same core root to them. And if you see the whole evolution
mm-hmm.
of Star Wars, in a very profound way, a lot of science fiction right after the so-called Golden Age is informed by what happened in World War II, and we are still living through
right.
some of the after effects of that when you think of things like Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle and how that's been the new adaptation. And, you know, all of these kinds of things are floating around that are still following on. I think we are seeing, as we live through the moments we're on right now, a body of science fiction that is very much about world communion versus the anti one world, anti mainstream media universe. And I think you could even see a film like Arrival as a reaction to that business, you see.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, do you think that we were seeing sci-fi that's springing from, you know, the war on terror and all that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Yeah, you see that all over the place. I mean, it's interesting to see Star Wars, of course, evolved throughout the course of its, you know, from 19 basically as Genesis in 73 and 4, the first films. And from that era, you kind of go along in the decades, look at the giant sweep of history. And while they, you could, you know, sort of see, you know, sort of, I don't know, a lot of people were embarrassed by 1, 2, and 3, although I'm a much more forgiving person. What you're seeing there is, you know, also the idea of dynasty building. You know, you sort of have the Bushes kind of showing up in all of that, and the evolution, really, you got to see all that there. And now what you're seeing is a kind of return to a kind of, gee, we're going to have to be grassrootsy if we're going to make change. That's very much the Rogue One piece. If you are a fan of the books, of course, I think there's something like, I think maybe 10 volume series about the Rogue Squadron and what evolved out of the Rogue Squadron. So Rogue One becomes an invention piece, not just as an, you know, interstitial between 3 and 4 in the Star Wars movies, but it also becomes sort of a key toward the invention of, you know, a whole line of story that occurs in 4, 5, and 6. And most specifically, it answers a question, because for reasons that are fascinating to me, people who are not science fiction fans are constantly saying things like, how can they, you know, this is, of course, this happened in 1977. How can they build this giant... Yeah, how can they build a giant starship and then it has a flaw? You know, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, you know. And you know, I'm sure that has been in George Lucas's craw all these years, you know.
This is the question I got yesterday when I was doing my review of the film on WBAL yesterday morning. And the first question I got was, does it answer why the Death Star has that one glaring weakness in it?
Yeah. I mean, if you don't know the history of military warfare, I'm here to tell you that there is nothing that's ever been built that doesn't have a glaring weakness. So this is not an oddity. You know, if you've ever seen, you know, the bombings of Pearl Harbor, and that one bomb that happens to go down into the magazine, you know, the armor magazine of the Arizona that explodes the whole ship. Every single, you know, thing in the world that we can build is going to have a flaw somewhere, as great as our technology is. And so I think that's kind of an obvious piece in terms of the creation of this you know. And as I say, I mean, it's a fun movie in a lot of ways, and it very much, and I agree with you completely, follows, because you'd mentioned this to me, and I'm sure it's in your review as well, it's very much a World War II movie in so many specifics, as well as the general arc of it all, you know.
Yeah, they take a lot of visual cues from specific battles, and, you know, we talked about Normandy and stuff like that. There are a lot of scenes like that, you know. Just imagine Ed Walker's Storm of the Beach of Normandy.
There's the Band of Brothers piece, but there's also that, I mean, it's kind of like the Battle of Bastogne, in which, you know, or even a World War One paradigm where, you know, it's kind of like you're just fighting this insane battle, and, you know, there's almost nothing to gain, and everybody's going to wind up dead, and that you kind of get those things in a lot of war scenarios anyway, you know.
Yeah.
Like Pork Chop Hill and all those kind of movies.
And there's also heist elements in this movie too, which I also appreciate quite a bit. Those are my favorite genre of movies. I love heist movies. But, you know,
I thought it was chess movies was your favorite genre of movies, but okay.
No. I like those too, though. But you know, for anybody who doesn't know what the plot of Rogue One is, and believe it or not, I still get a lot of questions about it, because there is some confusion, you know, and this is, I think, a kind of a mistake on Disney's part, which is to interrupt the prime narrative with a spinoff like this that kind of goes back in time. I think that's confused a lot of people, wondering where Rey and Finn are. Well, they're not in this.
Kathleen Kennedy said that, you know, what Lucas had said was you can have these standoffs as long as they're utterly independent of the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and now coming 8 series. And so therefore Rogue One and the next one that's coming, I think there's both the Han Solo and Boba Fett one, will be basically, you know, origin stories that are standalones, that are not, you know, that give you a little information on the tale, you know.
You and I get it, but your casual viewer is a little, I think, is still a little confused by it. Like I said, I've gotten questions about, like, where a certain character's at. And, you know, and my explanation is simple. You know, this is not a continuation. This goes back just before Star Wars, A New Hope.
Yeah.
And it follows, yeah. The rebels as they try to steal the Death Star plans, which Luke Skywalker needs to blow up the Death Star in Star Wars.
Yes.
So,
yeah. I mean, and in fact, remember, Luke is part of the Rogue Squadron. I mean, that's kind of the whole thing. These are this band of brothers, these the best pilots, and each one of these people, incidentally, has a freaking name.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess the thing that has thrown off a lot of critics, including with the Washington Post, is the issue of using, I'm not revealing too much, I think, to say that there are certain people who appeared in 4, 5, and 6 who
yes.
wind up in this, sort of in between this interstitial in a somewhat surprising and often very gratifying way. I was completely comfortable with it, by the way. I had no problem.
I was comfortable with that, too. And I actually think that makes sense, especially when you see how closely this one links to episode 4. It makes
yeah.
sense to have people that are in both movies. Now, we're not talking too many huge characters. There are a couple,
no.
but it was the smaller characters that showed up that I found to be more rewarding than anything, because it's like,
yeah.
oh wow, you know, I was just like, okay, yeah, that's cool, that because it brings a little bit of that familiarity, that nostalgia, that you know, like that The Force Awakens, you know, so obviously catered to. You get a little bit of that in this movie while taking the Star Wars movies in a totally different direction, tone-wise. You know, like I've said before, this is the first Star Wars movie to me that feels like a war film. The rest of them
yeah.
always felt like adventure fantasy movies to me, not necessarily.
Well, I kind of think number 5 is a pretty good war film. I mean, you know, that is a pretty dark story, and
yeah,
you know, and The Empire Striking Back is, you know, a familiar feel. In kind of every war has one of those where, you know, the guys you're fighting against mount, you know, a huge offensive, you know, the Tet Offensive or whatever, and that comes to be the thing, and that's very common in war, and that one struck me as more like that. But I mean, look, there have been plenty and plenty of, back to Star Trek, some of the most intelligent treatments of war, strategy, tactics, long-term alliances that fall apart, and then allying with enemies because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That comes up in the Star Trek universe all over the place, and most brilliantly. I mean,
yeah.
it's really genuine intelligence and military strategy, and kind of you talk about our issues of alliances and what we've gone through, and as a history, as a nation, or as a world, that's dealt with extensively in Star Trek, I think.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. So what were your favorite aspects of this movie? Without giving too much away, they got a lot of colorful characters. There are a lot of, you know, a lot of big scenes here that I think make you look at certain familiar scenes in a different light. But what were some of the aspects of this movie that were some of your favorite?
I thought the issue of how the Force is used was quite intelligently handled. I mean, you have sort of a spiritual aspirant who shows up there. I mean, you have, you know, a scene in which you have, and I think it's not revealing anything to say that Darth Vader, who of course is in, you know, 1, 2, and 3, as it were, winds up in this interstitial before number 4. And, you know, he of course has complete, you know, mastery in a dark way over this. But what about a person who has aspirations and may not have gone through complete Jedi training? I think that's a very interesting piece to the film.
Yeah.
Actually, and also as a payoff, you know. Which I appreciate. And incidentally, like in all science fiction, always you can do things that predate what happened in actual life. And I don't mean the invention of the submarine or of satellites. I mean things like having, you know, black people kiss white people and having black presidents, or in this case, the amazing use of, I mean, I think there's a lot of dignity in the use of Asians in this film. And of course, the whole Latino thing. Some people were concerned about the casting of a Latino actor in a very important role. And I think this is the kind of thing that doesn't just help to internationalize a project, but really reflects where we are headed, regardless of what may be happening politically as we speak this second, you know.
Yeah, you got to remember that, you know, nowadays the market isn't the United States anymore; it's the world.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
almost every blockbuster franchise now has a cast that is as ethnically diverse as they can possibly make it, and you know, and we've seen box offices grow as a result. So it's not a surprise.
That's true,
that all
but you know,
Star
Wars
going that route.
We had Lando Calrissian in 1980, for example, and you know, that I think that's a very
right.
positive thing. Or the original Star Trek, which you know premiered on my birthday in 1966. So I mean, there's a huge looking ahead to all of these things, and I do think that is a future that is in place, and I. You know, and you know, there's no putting that toothpaste back in the tube. And science fiction is really wonderful at handling and dealing with these sorts of things. Oh, and can we reveal the voice of Darth Vader? Is that cheating?
No, that's fine. I don't think it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of using James Earl Jones again is, you know, I mean, it's not just continuity. It's, you know, it's so right in every way. The other thing I think that's brilliantly done in this, we have an interstitial robot. That is to say, someone who's not quite as advanced as C-3PO, and it's a military robot, but it's more advanced than the 1, 2, and 3 robots, and he's defective, which is hilarious, you know.
He's probably the source of the most laughs in the movie too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
He's hilarious throughout the movie.
And
he's
again,
in a, he's in the clip I played at the beginning, and he's great in that.
And again, one
Alan
of the things,
Hughes, by the way.
Well, plus, it also gives tremendous pathos. I mean, there's one of the most poignant moments in the film deals with this robot as well.
Yes, that is true. And you know, I find that the robots in Star Wars, people feel about them the way they. Probably more about them than they feel about a lot of the human characters, you know, which I find is awful. But that, then again, I think it's like that for almost all science fiction that people
absolutely.
Love the robots just as much as they do people.
We are working in science fiction, so hard about what this, you know, our intelligence is going to mean. What does artificial intelligence really mean? Look at Westworld now. An inversion of the original Westworld from all those years ago with Michael Crichton. I mean, you know, look at how many great science fiction films are dealing with this issue. I mean, all of the Hers and all these ones that, you know, have female looking androids and on and on and on. I mean, this is an issue that we better be dealing with because it's hard upon. This isn't something that we can be putting off. This is not just Zumbas cleaning our floors. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And did you ever see that movie Morgan that came out a few months ago?
You know, I didn't see it. I heard about it. It looked interesting. How was it?
See, I liked it more than everybody else seemed to like it. A lot of people didn't seem to dig it all that much. But I thought that it was an interesting take on the whole artificial intelligence thing. You know, and we always expect the artificial intelligence to turn rogue and go evil at some point.
Yes.
So I think there's a little bit of a different spin that goes on with it that I think you would find interesting. So
no, I will definitely look for that one.
Yeah, and then
you and I
we got passengers coming up, so I hope you'll be at the screen for that on Monday.
Yes, we do. It's funny because at the same time you have that film, you have to think back on to what extent are we having an inversion, because this may not be as sophisticated or as intelligent or as profound as, you know, the new Ridley Scott project or the sequel to Blade Runner or all these kinds of things. And I'm hoping that this has something to it. I know there's a you probably know the ending because I like not to know. It's a surprise ending, of course, for all this thing that's happening.
Yeah.
But of course, remember science
fiction. Yeah, I seem to recall when the movie was first being, you know, talked about, because when it was first being made, it was Keanu Reeves and Reese Witherspoon as the duo, and then it kind of hit a wall, and then it was Keanu Reeves and Rachel McAdams, and then the movie went into limbo for a while, and during that whole period, I think they gave away what the secret, what the big twist was.
Wow.
And then, when the project really got moving with Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence, they quieted down about it. I think they unless they've rewritten aspects of it, I think I know what the big twist is, but I can't wait to find out if that's true on Monday, because that's one of the ones I'm looking forward to, and I'm kind of like I'm not expecting it to be I'm not expecting it to be Arrival. I don't think it's going to be saying a whole lot. I think it's going to be trying to be entertaining more than anything else, and that's fine. But I'm curious to find out.
I mean, while we're on this issue, before we leave it, before Incorporated was premiered right after the election, as many commentators said, the idea that, you know, massive billionaires will be in control of et cetera, seemed absurd. However, where we are with this, you know, before Elysium, before all of these, there were a whole body of works in science fiction, really in the 50s, this was a big deal as well, about the idea that big corporations, that large, you know, scale economic interests were going to be the controlling thing in the world. And so, you know, you have that subtext, literally Alien has that subtext. The stupid, you know, corporations, they're only greedy, they only want, they don't care about people, they just care about the discovery or whatever it might be. And, and of course everybody wants to use these things for their own power and on and on and on. I appreciate science fiction, and I was a little sorry you had to do this in Arrival because you kind of have to do this where you have the, you know, everybody wants to blow it up because they distrust, you know, the aliens kind of thing. I want to see more of the kind
that
of
was
science
the one
fiction.
Aspect of the movie that was the one aspect of the movie that I didn't really like. So it felt like it was brought in from something else.
It's one of the genius moments in films like Contact or earlier on, speaking of the people we've been talking about. I don't know if you remember the original campaign because you were probably not born yet, but before Close Encounters of the Third Kind came as a film, it was all about horror. I mean, the entire campaign in advance was fear. And you had this, you know, car driving down a road, and all of a sudden this giant light comes up at the end of the road, and I was thinking, holy crap, how can this be a horror movie? How can these be yet more invaders? And that was one of the great geniuses of that it wasn't that, you know. And I think we need to see I would like to see a little more positive spin on things. It would be kind of nice to see somewhere up in here, you know. But hey, who knows? Who knows? Yeah.
Well, Robert, this has been fantastic, man. And the next time something sci-fi, big sci-fi comes out, you and I are going to have to talk again.
Well,
if we don't get
you
to talk about
You and I were talking earlier. We're looking ahead at what's coming. And after Passengers, it's a long, thin road in 2017. You have plenty of superheroes, but not much science fiction. So I'm a little sad about that, too.
Yeah, a lot of blockbusters, not a ton of sci-fi. So maybe we'll get a chance to talk about Passengers in a little bit. So
that'd be fun.
This has been fantastic, man. Thanks for coming on. And we'll do this again soon. And I will see you in the studio at some point, hopefully. We'll see you on Monday.
If there's that, and that'll be good. And we have to talk about the Oscar race among ourselves.
Yes.
So if you're having a Titanic panel, let me know.
All right, will do, man. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you coming on.
You bet. Thank you, my friend. Appreciate it. Good luck, everybody. Bye.
All right, that was Robert R. Davis of WETA Roundtown. That's my man right there. He can talk about anything. And you heard how smart he is when it comes to sci-fi. Guy knows about everything. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. I'm going to come back. We're going to do DVDs and some news. And then we're going to get out of here. So I'll be right back. Did the score for Rogue One, a Star Wars story. All right, let's talk about what's coming out on DVD and Blu-ray next week. This will be December 20th, just in time for Christmas in case you need some stocking stuffers. A few that are probably worth, well, a couple that are maybe worth picking up to some people. The first is Sully. This is the Tom Hanks film directed by Clint Eastwood, in which Hanks plays Captain Sully Sullenberger, who the hero pilot who landed his plane on the Hudson, his damaged plane on the Hudson, saving the lives of everybody on board. This is a movie that I enjoyed. I think Hanks is terrific because as Sully, it's kind of a subtle, reserved film to go along with Hanks's subtle, reserved performance as Sully, who, if you ever, you know, seen the man or heard him talk, he's a very quiet, kind of introspective kind of guy. And I think Hanks embodies that perfectly. It's really a movie about hero worship. And not necessarily from the perspective of the people doing the worshiping, but from the guy who's being worshipped. And Sully went through this period where everybody, you know, looked at him as a hero. And the movie is about him and kind of this dichotomy, because, like you said, there are these people who are, you know, idolizing him. You know, your average person is idolizing him on the street. But behind the scenes, he's being grilled by the safety board about his actions, the actions he took, and whether or not he truly was a hero. Or did he do something? Did he screw up? Which is amazing when you think that he saved all those lives. He's being targeted like that. So it's a movie that's worth watching. I still don't think necessarily that it's an Oscar movie the way some people think. But it's probably going to get in the Best Picture race. You know, I don't think it'll win, but I think it'll find its way into the top 9 or 10. Magnificent Seven is the remake starring Denzel Washington and Chris Pratt, directed by Antoine Fuqua. This was a solid, fun movie, and that's really all it was. There's nothing else to it. It's not even as deep as the original, and which to me wasn't particularly deep either. But this one is even less so. It's just fun. If you like watching all these stars, you know, run around and shoot guns and stuff like that, then, you know, act cool, act tough, you know, in the Old West, then Magnificent Seven is for you. It's a perfectly fine film. Storks is the animated movie. I think Andy Samberg voices one of the storks in this one. I think he plays the stork. I did not ever see this. I think the guy person who reviewed it for us gave it a decent rating. But I tend to avoid the kind of random animated movies. If it's not Pixar or Disney or something like Trolls, then I probably won't go see it. But Storks is out. And 31, this is the new movie from Rob Zombie, which I also did not see because it didn't screen here and it barely played in any theaters. They had like a special Fathom Events showing like one night only and then it was it. And that's not a way to get me into the theater to see it. Sorry, that's the worst way, actually. A couple of news items on my list. Like I said earlier, they all have to do with Warner Brothers superhero movies. They're all part of the DCU. So let's start with what I think is the most interesting news of them all, which is Margot Robbie and David Ayer, who worked together on Suicide Squad. Now, we knew that Robbie was coming back as Harley Quinn in some kind of spinoff movie that would also feature other DCU female characters. Well, now we know that movie is going to be called Gotham City Sirens. And we could see the likes of, well, besides Harley Quinn, we could see the likes of Catwoman and Poison Ivy in that movie and probably some others. What Ayer is going to be, David Ayer is going to be directing that as well. So he and Robbie will be working together again, which makes perfect sense. Ayer loved working on Suicide Squad. Even though we might miss his cop movies for a while, no more police movies for a bit. I like him in the DCU. I like him as a superhero director. And all he's making tough, gritty movies, I'm fine with it. And this one should be too. I mean, it's called Gotham City Sirens, so it's going to be taking place in Gotham City, which is the grittiest place in all of DC, all of the DC universe. So that one sounds like it could be pretty good. Now, a rumor was out there that Megan Fox could be playing Poison Ivy. Bleeding Cool had a report that she's been ordering comics. I don't know how they know this, but she's been ordering comics featuring Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy, who are like the package deal. They're like always together, kind of a Thelma and Louise thing. So we could be seeing Megan Fox as Poison Ivy, which I would be down for also. I think that would be cool. Fox and Robbie together on screen. God, that would be hot. Patrick Wilson is joining the Aquaman movie, playing Orn, a.k.a. Ocean Master. Now, Orn is the half-brother to Aquaman, the jealous half-brother. So you're getting kind of a Thor-Loki thing going on there. So Wilson joins Jason Momoa and Amber Heard in the film. Heard plays Mira, who is Aquaman's wife. So the cast is starting to shape up for that one. And finally, Ben Affleck says he won't be rushing into the Batman movie, his directorial effort, The Batman. He's not going to be rushing into that one. He's going to be taking his time, and they're still working out the script. Now, a Warner Brothers exec who was on his way out, I guess Greg Silverman, recently commented that we could be seeing The Batman in 2018, which would mean that filming on the movie would probably be getting started early to mid next year. But none of that is confirmed. I don't know. This one seems to be taking its time, and Warner Brothers is going to let Affleck take all the time he needs. Now, the thing is, Affleck's movie is going to come before Justice League 2. That's what they wanted anyway. The fact they're bumping Justice League 2 backwards in order to make room for the Batman, which has given Zack Snyder time to direct something else entirely. He's going to be directing The Last Photograph, which is a movie he's been trying to make for a few years. So they want the Batman to come between Justice League and Justice League 2. But it's going to depend on Affleck, who doesn't seem like he's in any kind of a hurry. And since he's their golden boy, though, I think they'll clear as much space for him as he needs. So we'll see what happens there. All right. That's the main news that I had for you today. That pretty much wraps up our show. It's kind of a short one, which I wanted it to be because we were only talking about Star Wars. And it's a big week. It's Star Wars week. I want to leave as much time available for you to go and see Rogue One as possible. You don't need me holding you back from that, right? In fact, I'm going to go see it myself tomorrow on Saturday. I'm going to the gigantic IMAX at the Uvar Hazy here in Chantilly, near Chantilly. So I'm going to be checking it out again with some friends. I can't wait. It's going to be awesome. And who knows, I might see it again after that with some other friends. All right, so let's. Where's our music? Didn't start. There it is. I want to thank everybody for joining me today on Cinema Royale to hear me and Robert Aubrey Davis talk about Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Make sure you go and check it out. It's in theaters right now. I think I heard it made $30 million in Thursday night previews or something like that, which is insane. It's going to be huge this weekend. Look out for the box office report on PunchDrunkCritics.com this Sunday morning when that drops. I'm Travis Hobson. You can find me on PunchDrunkCritics.com, of course, here on Cinema Royale, on WETA Around Town with Robert Aubrey Davis, who was here earlier. And the WBAL Morning News, Thursday mornings. Go to WBAL.com for that. All right. This has been Cinema Royale. Thanks for joining me. I will talk to you guys soon. We're coming down to the end of the year. We got Christmas coming up, so I don't know if I'll be able to do a show next week. Then we got the new year, so it's going to be tight. But we also got to do an end-of-the-year type thing, right? So keep an eye on PunchDrunkCritics.com for that. Follow me on Twitter at PunchDrunkCritics for that as well. And find out what's going to be going on. And, of course, the Cinema Royale Facebook page. All right, thanks a lot. Talk to you soon. Happy holidays. Goodbye.